Okay, welcome everyone. After having experienced the ordeal of Haman's edict against the Jews and succeeding in reversing the potential devastation that could have been brought upon the Jews of that time, Esther comes before the Chachamim of her time, and in Masechet Megillah, in source number 1, we learn, Shalcha lahem Esther lachachamim kitvuni ledorot. Please write down the story of Purim so that generations after can read and understand its message. Now, there is a debate among Chazal as to whether Megillat Esther should have been included among Sifrei Tanakh, but in the end, at the very end of Perek Tet in the Megillah, we read, V'nichtav b'sefer, that her book was the final text within the 24 books of Tanakh. This is very different than what we learn, for example, in Masechet Shabbat about Chanukah, which is a miracle that occurred after the events of Purim. And in Masechet Shabbat, the Chachamim decide Chanukah lo nitna lihikatev. The Chanukah was a holiday that was not going to be written down and included within the books of Tanakh. So we want to ask a question. Why dafka did Esther insist that what transpired throughout the course of a number of years to the Jews in the Persian Empire needed to be written down? And when we deal with a written text and not an oral tradition, it's important to delve into understanding how the form of the text coheres with its content. In actuality, Esther was saying, I don't want this to be a story that is transmitted from generation to generation, from parent to child, in an oral fashion. I want it written down. This is the way that I am going to preserve for posterity everything that transpired. The written form has a power in and of itself to transmit a message, which she felt in this particular scenario, sometimes the orally, the message will not be fully preserved. So we need to understand why is it that Esther insisted, Kitvuni ledorot, that everything must be written down. How did she, in conveying in a written form, how did she manage to convey the angst, the anxiety, the subsequent joy and exhilaration of having survived the potential destruction of the Jewish people? So one of the literary devices adopted by Esther and Mordechai is that of the Milah Mancha, the guiding word, a word that repeats itself in key aspects of the narrative. And if you follow this term throughout the whole Megillah, you will be able to discern its overriding message and motifs. And this word is the word dat, dalid taf. It occurs 19 times in Megillat Esther. The only other places that this word appears is in Sefer Daniel, where it discusses Daniel's experiences with the Persian administration, and a few times in Sefer Ezra. Only one other place, possibly, the term dat appears in Sefer Dvarim. We will talk about that later. In actuality, the term dat is not a Hebrew word. It's a Persian derivative, and it conveys and illustrates a Persian concept. Within the context of this Megillah, the primary sense of the term dat is a royal edict, stamped with the seal of the king. A permanent edict in the law books of Persia, but many times it also refers to other types of laws and ordinances, sometimes to the norms, the mores, the customs, the ethical standards of that particular society. In fact, while we understand the term dat in later Hebrew to mean religion, that's not what its original meaning is. And there really is no biblical word for the idea or the term religion. But there are also related words in the Megillah, which we are going to follow in this vein. Words like ketav, davar. The term ketav does not just mean script, it also means a law or an ordinance. A term like mitzvah, ma'amar, tzivui, all indicating different forms of commands that are transmitted orally or in writing throughout the events of the Megillah. What we need to understand as key to the Megillah is that while the Egyptians would worship their king as a god, they thought Pharaoh was divine, the Persians did not think so necessarily about their kings. Kings were not gods, but the law, the dat, was. Persians were not only slaves to their gods, but to their laws. Laws acquired an autonomy in and of themselves. Once the law was transmitted and it was formally instituted, it transcended all human authority and acquired a kind of independent reality of its own. So if we follow these words throughout the Megillah, we will find that there's an interesting synergy between the literary structure and formulation of the Megillah and its overall message. Furthermore, we're going to see that if we follow through on these particular words, we will be able to extrapolate the overriding theme of the Megillah, as we all know, the message of V'nahafochu, that because of the reversal of the edict, the enemies of the Jews who were supposed to gain the upper hand did not. Everything was overturned and reversed. The Jews ended up ruling, they ended up conquering. V'nahafochu. We're dealing with a topsy-turvy world. The irony and paradox of the Megillah is going to be perpetuated if we follow this Milah Mancha of Dat and its related terms. Because throughout the Megillah, we tend to find that there's always a semblance of stability, of order, of Dat, of the perpetuation of cultural norms. But there's always the opposing current of instability, discord, rebellion, challenge to the establishment of the edicts and norms that occur in critical junctures throughout the narrative. And this challenge is what controls the progression of the plot of the Megillah. There's always that push-pull, the law and order, and the opposing trends of challenging the law and the order, and the bold individuals who stand up to challenge the dat in the Megillah. Furthermore, we're often at a bit of a quandary as to whose order is being followed. At times, Ahasuerus seems to go through official legal channels, as we will see with the edict of what shall we do with the rebellious Vashti, or how do we honor Mordechai. Other times, his own personal decision, without seeking out the advice of various counselors and advisors, comes into play, as, for example, asking to bring Vashti to the party or choosing Esther as his wife. So there's not only a tension in the Megillah between law and no law, but whose law are we following at a particular juncture within the narrative? And this leaves open the question, who really is in charge? Who is making the laws in the Megillah? Is it Ahasuerus, Haman, Mordechai, Esther, many players, so that ultimately when we have so many players and our heads are turning this way and that, we begin to realize that maybe in the end it is the law, i.e. Hashem, who is manipulating all of the events behind the scenes. The topsy-turvy world of Megillat Esther, where nothing is as it appears. This tone is set at the beginning of the Megillah. The very first time that we encounter the term dat is in the second paragraph in source 2, where we learn v'hashtia chadat ein ones. At the beginning of the Megillah, Ahasuerus makes a number of parties. We don't really know exactly historically why he's making these parties at during the third year of his reign. There are many issues regarding exactly where historically we should position the story of Purim. We will talk about some of the historical speculations later on as during the Shir. But it is very interesting that while Rashi, who had adopted the opinion of the Seder Olam Rabbah, the chronology work of Rav Yosef Bar Chalavta, indicated that Ahasuerus was the son of Cyrus, who had ruled at the end of the 70 years of Galut Babel, there is an opinion in source number 3 where Rav indicates Shemalach Me'atzmo, that in fact this individual, Ahasuerus, was not necessarily of royal descent. Either this is to his credit, he took the initiative because no one else was fit for the reign, or to his discredit that he bought the throne with money. Malbim therefore indicates, and this is a very important opinion, whether historically it is true or not, ultimately, it is a very important insight that Rav has really extrapolated from the beginning text of the Megillah. Because what do we read at the very beginning of the Megillah? Vayhi bimei Ahasuerus, hu Ahasuerus hamolech mehodu ve'ad kush. It was in the days of Ahasuerus. Who is Ahasuerus? He is Ahasuerus. Why doesn't it say Ahasuerus ben a particular individual? Darius, if there are those who say he's the son of Darius, ben Dalyavish. Who is Ahasuerus? All the Megillah wants you to know is he is Ahasuerus. So whether he is of royal descent or not, the Megillah seems to be pointing out he comes across initially as being a renegade, as being someone who doesn't seem to be following and towing the royal line. Notice it says Hamolech, who rules Mehodu ve'ad Kush, but it doesn't say initially Melech Ahasuerus. It doesn't give him that title. And in fact, this is the only place where it says Hamolech. Throughout the rest of the Megillah, it's like the Megillah goes out of its way to say no, Melech Ahasuerus. So at this point, it seems that there has been a measure of instability within the kingdom, and Ahasuerus is trying to impose his authority on his rather newly formed, expanded empire. Malbim says, Uratzan, source 3, Listarer alehem bechoska, v'mamlechet b'mamlacha bilti mugbelet. He wanted to have a limitless, right, all-expansive, all-encompassing reign over the kingdom, and therefore he decided to make parties. Well, what is a party going to accomplish? First of all, of course, we learn from Herodotus's histories that the Persians were known for wine drinking at their parties. In fact, it is known that they often decided a lot of important issues when they were drunk. Of course, when they sobered up, they often reconsidered things that they decided about when they were drunk. But it's not always going to be in the case, certainly not in the case with regards to the episode with Vashti. Nevertheless, what is happening here is that Ahasuerus is attempting to curry favor with the people. And how does he curry favor? Hashtiyah chadat ein ones. The law, the dat is what? Ein ones. There is no law. There is no coercion. One way to understand it is now you can drink as much as you want. Or royal wine that was usually left only for the elites and the king is now being passed out to be drunk among the masses, among the lay people. Nevertheless, what is the key? It's la'asot kirtzon ish va'ish. What is the law? The law, there is no law. There is no bounds. There is no restrictions. Whatever you want to do, la'asot kirtzon ish va'ish, go right ahead and do it. So already the Megillah is portraying Ahasuerus as one for whom there is no abiding law. He will constantly be manipulated. We are going to see that by his advisor Haman. In the end, he will be manipulated by Mordechai via Esther. We're dealing with a world of contradictions where he's overturning the norm, reversing what society anticipates, what it is used to. The dot is that there is no law. What every man decides for himself is fine with him. There's no sense but a state of dissonance. What appears to be an attempt to establish stability is actually accomplished through the free reign of the individual will. So how insightful is it that in source number 5, the Gemara in Masechet Megillah tells us, La'asot kirtzon ish va'ish, La'asot kirtzon Mordechai ve'haman. Or, because in the Megillah, who are the individuals referred to as ish? Mordechai, Ish Yehudi, and Haman, Ish Tzar V'Oyev. Obviously, very prescient that the Gemara is telling us, ultimately, Ahasuerus will be influenced by the wills of two individuals called Ish, and truthfully, what is his law, what is his will, one begins to wonder. Nevertheless, in source number 4, the Megillah does attempt to tell us that one of the other undercurrent innuendos of the idea of Hashtiyah Chadad Ein Ones is that Ahasuerus knows no restrictions in the sense that he also is trying to show how much he can flaunt his newly acquired authority and powers. So that the text tells us, based on Pasuk Zayin, V'hashkot b'chlei zahav, v'chelim mikelin shonim, v'yein malchut rav kiyad ha-melech, that he would give them to drink from golden vessels, various beakers or vessels of varied designs, mikelim shonim, and the wine was in great abundance, kiyad ha-melech, as befits a king. Says the Gemara in source number 4, if it meant different vessels, they maintain it should have said not kelim shonim, but kelim mishunim. Therefore, the Gemara says, rishonim kalu mipnei kelim, ve'atem shonim bahem. This is a reference to where I noted for you in Sefer Daniel, Belshazzar, who was the last king of the Babylonian Empire. Let's recall that the Persians, under Cyrus the Great, conquered the Persian Empire. And Belshazzar, in order to flaunt his very precarious authority, really before the downfall of the Babylonian Empire, decided to do something that even his great ancestor, Nebuchadnezzar, refused to do. And that is, he took out the kelim of the Beit HaMikdash, and he drank from them. In fact, when Nebuchadnezzar conquered our Yerushalayim, and he destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, and it does emphasize in Sefer Yirmiyahu that one of the signs of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash was that, in fact, the kelim, the vessels, the holy vessels of the Beit HaMikdash were themselves exiled. Remember when Titus carries that menorah to show the great victory. The emphasis over here is that Nebuchadnezzar, he put the kelim in the storehouses of the temple of his gods. He stored the kelim. He still understood that there's a measure of sanctity, that there's a certain respect and dignity that you give to these holy vessels. Belshazzar, who is very much on the end of his rope, takes out those very kelim and he disgraces them. And of course, in Sefer Daniel, it's very interesting that the language is played with, that it uses the verb hanpeik, nifak, that when Belshazzar took out the kelim, a finger came out, which seemed not to be attached to a hand, and it wrote the famous writing on the wall, which Daniel interprets to mean that Belshazzar, you're finished, and the Persians are going to now take over. Comes along, according to the Gemara, Ahasuerus Shoneh, he repeats the same mistake. You know why? Because we have to, and he's also, based on the language of Yikar Tiferet Gdulato, Ba'aratot Osher Kvod Malchuto, that Yikar Tiferet Gdulato, the Midrash in Esther Rabbah says, Bigdei Kehuna Gdolah Her Alehem, he took out the Bigdei Kehuna and he showed it to them. You see, we have to pay attention to a very interesting undercurrent within the story of the Megillah. 70 years have already passed. The Babylonian exile is over. Yirmiyahu had predicted that we would be redeemed. And yet what? We are not fully redeemed. There is no full Ge'ulah Shlema. We're still in Galut. We just transferred hands. We went from being under the sovereignty of the Babylonians to being under the sovereignty of the Persians. Of course, the question is, when is the Beit HaMikdash being built in reference to the story of Megillat Esther? We'll discuss that in a little bit. That is not so clearly known, and it is still disputed among historians. So Ahasuerus says, no holds barred, ein ones, no restrictions. I am truly the sovereign king, even over the Jews. Now comes the first paradox. Ahasuerus, in source number 6, at the end of Perek Aleph, commands Vashti to come before him at a party. Pay attention to the language in the third line of source number 6 when she refuses. She refuses lavov bidivar hamelech. We're not talking about an edict that has been sealed and stamped with the king's approval, one that's going to be in the law books for all time. It's a divar hamelech. It's a temporary command. It was apparently considered indecent for wives of Persian nobility to attend male drinking parties. That's why Vashti had made a separate party for women. Nevertheless, Vashti is called to and brought forth in order to show her off, of course, at Ahasuerus' party. Malbim picks up, however, based on the Midrashic tradition, that Vashti had her own yichus, that she indeed was from royalty. Malbim picks up on some of the innuendos in the language, because it says in Pasuk Yud Aleph that Ahasuerus commands lehaviet Vashti Hamalka. She's Vashti first. She's only Hamalka, the queen, because I made her queen. But in Pasuk Yud Bet, when our narrator tells us how she refused, how does it say it? Vatimayin Hamalka Vashti. She's like, oh, you got things all wrong here. I'm already a Malka. I'm already of royal descent. Who are you? And of course, that seems to support the opinion that Ahasuerus had very tenuous, legal rights to the throne. As the Yalkut Shimoni says, the Midrash says, Shotet Tipei, she says, you're a fool. Don't you know that I am a descendant of Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar? Ilu haya avik hayam lo haya noten otchali, that you would not have been married to me had we still been in power. Well, we're assuming, of course, that Ahasuerus is quite an insecure individual, and he wants to make sure that everyone knows whose authority is here. Interestingly, over here, Vashti, the woman's authority, is not going to be able to become predominant, whereas we all know what happens toward the end of the Megillah. So what is the irony here? The irony is, don't turn the page yet, the irony is that at a height of a party of no constraints, ein ones, the king is imposing a command on Vashti to come, even against her will, maybe we could say be'ones, in a form perhaps she does not want to come in. He has no compunction breaking cultural norms of society, if we assume women don't normally appear before the men. And he insists on bringing her, as we could say, shelo chadat, not according to cultural norm, in a humiliating manner. Things are topsy-turvy. They're not as they seem. There's an inconsistency in Ahasuerus' thinking. When Vashti challenges Devar HaMelech, a command that's only temporary, he now has a problem. So he calls in Kol Yode'ei Dat Vadin, all the sages who are learned in procedure, in protocol, and how to do things right. Kidat ma la'asot b'malkah Vashti al asher lo asita et ma'amar ha'melech. She even refused just a ma'amar. Well, it seems everyone's ready to pass the buck. No one stands up until Memuchan gets up. And what does he eventually say? He says, if you're going to allow Devar Hamalka to challenge Devar Hamelech, if you're going to allow the queen to challenge the will of the king, well, you just might as well pack it up right now. Notice that what Memuchan does is he cleverly takes this personal affront to the king. He channels it into having national and widespread reverberations, that it will affect microcosmically every single household. So what the king needs to do, as we learn in Pasuk Yotet, Im halamelech tov yetzei devar malchut. We need to make a devar malchut, an edict that is going to be an official royal permanent law that will be written down in the royal archives. Yikatev bedatei paras umadai velo yaavol. No exceptions. It can never be abrogated. Nishma pidgam ha-melech. It has to be a slogan that everyone talks about and everyone walks around saying, this is what happens when a woman challenges authority. Why? So that we end up with the situation of liyot kol ish sorer beveito, that a man is now going to rule in his household. The king obeys. Already we see Ahasuerus is delegating his authority to others. So what happens in source number 8 in Perek Bet? We now have a phrase that we are introduced to, which repeats itself throughout the entire Megillah in key places. The phrase, Devar HaMelech Vidato. We now have a new royal edict that sets out to counteract the devastating effects of the edict that he brought forth against Vashti. Notice it never tells us Vashti was actually killed, but I guess we can assume that. There's a new form of coercion, Devar HaMelech Vidato, which results in Vatilakach Esther, that she is taken forcefully against her will. We started out in a situation of Ein Ones, and now we've gone to the opposite extreme of Vatilakach. Devar HaMelech Vidato is now one of Ones, of coercion. But now, we have another dimension of law, of command, more of a personal nature. It's just going to throw a monkey wrench into everything. And that's the tzivui of Mordechai. Lo higida Esther en pasuk yud et amavet moladeta ki Mordechai tziva alea asher lo tagid. We have now that Esther's told not to reveal her origins. Why? I gave you some speculation in source number 9. Is it because he was hoping, if Ahasuerush thought she was from some lowly family, that he wouldn't choose her? Actually, that really might work in his favor. If he's insecure, he might really like that she's anonymous and mysterious, has no roots. It kind of plays into a contrast to the Hamalka Vashti. Ibn Ezra says if she keeps quiet, she'll be able to observe the Torah and mitzvot without having to be put into a situation of Kiddush Hashem, of Yehareg v'al Yavor, or Yavor v'al Yehareg. The Maharal says if we know where she comes from, all the other nations will be vying for the place as queen, and they will slander the nation from which she derives, which is exactly what happened to Daniel and will happen to Mordechai, and therefore better to keep quiet. Does Mordechai know that this anonymity will in the end serve him very well? One wonders. Esther's loyalty, however, to the tzav, the tzivui, the command of Mordechai, is going to clash with the loyalty to the authority, the laws, the edicts of the king. These loyalties will be at odds, and that is the key to the dynamic of the Megillah. But you know, one wonders, is it really possible that Esther got away with it, where nobody, even Ahasuerus, after he chooses her, nobody really wants to know where this woman comes from? Perhaps, in fact, they were asking. Because if you look in Pasuk Chaf, what do we learn? Ein Esther magedet moladta ve'etama kasher tziva alei Mordechai ve'amar Mordechai Esther osa. What is the verb magedet? That's a continuous present tense. It sounds like she is constantly being challenged. Please tell us, where do you come from? And yet somehow, with that wonderful, captivating chen v'chesed, she manages to get away with it and to evade the truth and remain loyal to Mordechai's wishes. In her own way, she is being passively a moredet b'malchut, a rebel. She's also a moredet b'malchut because initially she does not follow kedat hanashim, the typical laws, the typical norms and mores, how you prepare yourself to appear before the king. She only listens when Haggai says you better do something. And she, therefore, is showing, I'm not going to follow any kind of dat, whether it's the king's dat, whether it's the ethical and normal custom and customary behaviors of the nashim of the time. It's always emphasized over and over, vati lakach, that she is being forced against her will. She's going against cultural norms and practices. She's not revealing who she is. She won't cower to the norms of society. The irony is, no one is angry, and she is chosen as the queen. How ironic is that? And in the end, we're going to see that she's always going to be caught in her behavior, in her predicament. Does she follow Tzivui Mordechai? Does she go according to the dot of royal authority? Which one will ultimately prevail? Right now, her chen and her chesed, her mystique, some sort of X factor, some sort of captivating factor, manages to help her succeed at this juncture. Between the time when Esther is chosen and the point where she'll have to put herself out as queen, we know many events happen. But the important event in source number 10 is the goral, the pool, the lottery. Mordechai does reveal himself as a Jew. We know Haman represents him as Am Mordechai, as representative of the entire nation. There seems to have been a new tzivui, ki chen tzivalo amelech, possibly as the result of the rebellion of Bigtan and Teresh. The king is very nervous right now. He feels that his authority is being challenged, therefore he appoints a chief minister, an individual everyone has to bow down to, a conduit between himself and the people. What's ironic is, however, is that the way that Haman ultimately conducts himself is through a goral, through a pool. He places his fate in the hands of an unknown controlling force. We can say Hashem. But we would expect that for a new legal edict, it should have been something objective, logical, rational. And therefore, in the end, the fact that it derives from an illogical lottery, from a pool, a goral, is a very interesting tension that is added and dimension to the Megillah, that there's always an tension between the objective law on the one hand and that unexplainable X factor on the other hand, whether it's Esther's mysterious captivation or this factor of the lottery. And in fact, the Malbim points out that were it not for the lottery, the tragedy of Purim might have taken place. Remember, the pool was cast in the month of Nisan. The destruction is 11 months later. If it had not been delayed so long, who knows? Maybe, naturally, right, things might have not turned out as well as they did. But this proves that there is really a mysterious X factor, Hashem, who's working behind the scenes. Because in actuality, there is another dot that is going to intervene and invade the context of this story. And that is, as we learn in source number 11, when Haman, in the first official anti-Semitic speech, says to Achashverosh, Yeshno Am Echad Mefozal Meforad Bein Amim, V'chol Medinot Malchutecha, V'dateihem Shonot Mikol Am, V'datei Amelech Einam Osim. They beat to their own drummer. He knows Achashverosh is already paranoid about rebellion. He emphasizes this Am, they're very different. They're nonconformists. They're not unified. You're trying to create a unified kingdom. They're creating dissonance. They thrive on their diversity. They thrive on the fact that they're not interested in the sovereignty, the laws of the king. However, what is interesting is that the Gemara in source number 12, however, says that there's also an undercurrent that we need to take into consideration. The Gemara says, Yeshno am echad amar rava, amar le haman la chashverosh. Don't read yeshno, read yashnu, min hamitzvot. The Jews are asleep and not performing the mitzvot. We learn in another daf in Masechet Megillah that the students of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said, why would we even end up in a situation of a possible edict of genocide against us? The Jews were assimilated and enjoying the parties of the kings, of the king. What is interesting here is that perhaps we need to reinterpret Hashtia chadat ein ones la'atzot kirtzon ish va'ish. Because you have to understand, the Persian culture was different than other cultures. Other cultures, I would call them seek and destroy cultures. They go in, they destroy, they displace everyone, they scatter, you forget who you are and what you came from. The Persian culture was very different. They took over, but they kept everything in place. For example, in Sefer Daniel, we learn that Daniel, who was a major player in the Babylonian Empire, just moved right on and continued to be a major, maybe even more important of a player in the Persian government. The infrastructure, the whole bureaucratic system was just left in place. Actually, it's quite smart. But what's the point here? In essence, to a certain extent, the Persians were saying, let's try a different policy of assimilation. Ein ones, no restrictions, free reign, no holds barred. Lasot kiltson ish va'ish, let everyone do what they want. I.e. they're trying to win us over how? By this more seductive, soft approach. Look, he says, I'll make a beautiful palace, and a lot of the structure of the palace seems to be very parallel to the Beit HaMikdash. He seems to be wanting to try to imitate Shlomo HaMelech. He says, look, you know, I have a substitute kingdom for you here. Let's make it all good. We can all live together. So therefore, even though the Gemara is placing it very disturbingly in the mouth of Haman's anti-Semitic speech, saying, oh, don't worry, you don't have to worry, Ahasuerus, if you'll succeed. Those Jews, Hashem doesn't care about them anyway. Yashnu mina mitzvot, they're asleep, they're not following the mitzvot. Maybe there's something that is going on here that we're not paying total attention to. Even more so, that becomes acute when we start thinking about the chronology of the story of Purim. Because, according to modern historians, Ahasuerus is really, well, there's still an argument. Is he Xerxes? Is he Artaxerxes the first, Artaxerxes the second? No matter which king he is, let's say Xerxes the first, who's the earliest, he lived in 486 to 465 BCE. When was the second Beit HaMikdash completed? 516 BCE. And by the way, take note of the interesting that there's a lot of number 70s that circulate because it was destroyed when, according to historians, 586. It was the second Beit HaMikdash was completed when? 516, 70 years in between. Okay, the bottom line is that according to modern historians identifying Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes, they lived even much later, the second Beit HaMikdash is already built at the time of Megillat Esther. What's the problem? Where's the mass aliyah? The Jews are in Persia. Where is the mass aliyah to go and enjoy the second Beit HaMikdash? And all of Chazal and historians agree it's pre-Ezra going to and doing this major Renaissance movement. So are the Jews really very much in a state of malaise? Perhaps then we can capitalize on the fact that there is a possibility that the word dat is really found way before these exilic texts, Daniel, Esther, Ezra, and that is in Sefer Dvarim at the bottom of source 12, where we learn Hashem mi Sinai ba, v'zarach mi Seir lamo, etc. V'ata merivot kodesh mi mino esh dat lamo. Now you notice esh dat truly is a compound word. But notice that onklus translates eshta oraita. Ibn Ezra, citing the opinion of Sadia Gaon, understands esh dat, notice how he even wrote it as two separate words already, ha-Torah shenitna be'esh U Barak, i.e. what is happening here is that we are in a situation where we are not following our dat, the dat that was given Be'esh Uvarak. And although Haman is saying to Ahasuerus, Dateyem Shonot, we're nonconformists, we're different, how much is that truly the reality on the ground? Therefore, when Mordechai says in chapter 4, okay, so Ahasuerus gives in, and we see that, just pay attention to the language in source 11, Ahasuerus says, "Do katov be'enecha." By the way, you can follow the word tov throughout the Megillah and get more motifs extracted by that. Notice, it's even though it's b'shem ha-melech Ahasuerus, it's kechol asher tziva Haman. He's giving in without even going through the regular legal channels. So, when on the next page, Devar HaMelech VeHadat, nitna b'shushan abira. We notice what happens? Another party. Notice how parties are always involved with dat. How interesting. And we end up that laws involve always partying. But in this case, ha'ir shushan navocha, we are all dumbfounded and we are all bewildered because a law is supposed to establish harmony. It's supposed to dissipate discord. It's supposed to create stability. And here is the opposite situation. Ha'il Shushan Navocha. She's bewildered, dumbfounded. We're causing senseless killing of innocents. So Mordechai says, when they hear Devar HaMelech V'dato in source 13, Mordechai says to her, you need, he commands her, now a new command, litzavot alea, and he says, you have to go to the king, lihitchanen lo, you have to beg. By the way, in this context where I italicize, the word hamelech is repeated 5 times. Now, Esther, she says, look, I don't beg. I'm a queen. I have dignity. So I don't beg. But she says, I want to do things my way. The problem is, you have an intervening dat, right? How can she come to the king? Asher lo yikare achat dato lehamit. Because the dat, this is not just a mama, this is not just a tzivui, this is not just a devar, it's a dat, it's etched in stone. You don't go to the king unless you're called to the king. So therefore, she says, the only way I'm going to succeed, right, she asks Mordechai, to tell everyone to fast is because she says, only if we place, if I'm going to challenge one law in order to revoke yet another law, we have to put in between a wedge the true dat of the Torah. There needs to be tshuva, and only if that's accomplished, avo al amelech asher lo chadat v'chasher avadati avadati. What's very interesting is that when she does go before the king in source 14 and he accepts her, there's yet another party. New edict is going to be, a new command is going to be enforced, and it's always going to be in the environment of a party. Maharu et Haman in source 14 on Pasuk Hei La'asot et Devar Esther. She says, I want a party. And you're going to do, says Ahasuerus, complying, Devar Esther. How interesting, especially if Mimuchan is identified as Haman at the beginning of the Megillah. Initially, he doesn't want a woman's Devar Hamalka to prevail. Now all of a sudden the tables have been turned, Esther is in control. But here's the irony. She's going against, or Ahasuerus is going against his own dat. He's letting her, first of all, come see him without being called. This now strengthens her position by saying to Haman, no, you don't do Devar HaMelech, you do what? Devar Esther. So is it Ish Sorer Beveto, or is it Isha Soreret Beveta? She's manipulating everything, and Haman is doing exactly what she wants. Now women instruct, men, they listen. But how amazing is it that initially, Vashti was the one, when she challenged, not even a dot, she just challenged a temporary edict of the king to bring her to a party, off with her head, right? She was immediately killed, whereas Esther, who's challenging a dot, for which she says explicitly, the punishment is lehamit, is death, she ends up getting away with it, nahafochu, and she ends up being able to control the situation. The next day when they come, she says, don't worry, let's have a second party. And then she says, don't worry. Umachar e'eseh ki devar hamelech. Tomorrow I will do what? Devar hamelech. So Rashi asks the question, what devar hamelech are you even talking about? What command is she going to be fulfilling? What command are we even talking about? Rashi says, amazingly, ma shebikasht mimeni, I'm going to reveal to you my origins. She has really been manipulating, says Rashi, the situation all along. And now she will reveal her origins when it plays into her hands, when she's in control. And in fact, what's very interesting is that when she does talk about herself to and revealing Haman as the enemy. You can see in the top of the column in Perek Zayim across from source 13, she says, actually I should have quoted you the pasuk beforehand, Tinlaten li nashi v'she'elati ve'ami bevakashati. Nimkanu ani ve'ami. She focuses what? On herself first, and then she focuses on her nation. She says, you care about me? Let's talk about me, and then we'll talk about everyone else. Hey, I want to conclude. I'll just conclude with one last major thought, and then we'll wrap it up. And that is, ultimately, when Esther wins the battle, she begs. In Source 16, she finally begs. Vatitchanenlo. Why does she beg? Because she knows she has a big problem. The laws of Persia are ein lahashiv. You cannot revoke the edict. So now she has to get rid of this edict. But it's not Devar HaMelech V'dato, which you can't, that's irrevocable. She hints, however, there might be a way around it. When this edict was originally promulgated, and he said, Achashverosh said, Du katov be'enecha, it sounded like it was Devar HaMelech, Pak Shegen HaKtav, Katev Linatein Dat. Now, all of a sudden, she says, wait a minute. Vatidchanen lo lahavir et ra'at Haman ha'agagi ve'et machashavto asher chashav ala yudim. Yikatev lahashiv et hasfarim machashevet Haman ben amedata ha'agagi asher katav le'abed. She says, no, this is not an edict of the king. She says it was just one individual evil person, this renegade person who cooked up this horrible machshava and this ra'ah. And therefore, she says, and that's why the king says, Katov Beinechem. He says, fine, you can now do a way of revoking it. You're not really revoking it, you're just overriding it, because now she says, look, you have a way out. This wasn't your official royal edict, it was just Haman's private plan scheme, and you certainly want nothing to do with it anymore. Ibn Ezra actually says a different kind of nafochu, you can read it on your own when you have a chance. So therefore, we end up with a total nahafochu situation. In Perek Gimel, when it said, Vayikatev kechol asher tziva Haman, now in Perek Chet, it's Vayikatev kechol asher tziva Mordechai. The edict has been changed. Certainly now, when we have Devar HaMelech V'dato in Perek Tet, the new Devar HaMelech V'dato is what? V'na'afochu asher yishlitu ayudim heima b'son ehem, that we now rule over our enemies. And it's hadat nitna b'shushan habira, but it's no longer navocha, but what? Ha'ir shushan tzahala v'samecha. So to end off, in source 18 in Perek Tet, if you go through the Perek, you will find that there are two words that are very importantly repeated throughout the entire Perek. Number one, nikalu, kahal, kihila, gathering, assembly. It happens that in Sefer Dvarim, Matan Torah is called Yom HaKahal. And of course, we read 2 weeks ago, Parshat HaKahal, and we are Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe Morasha, Kihilat Yaakov. The important thing is that what the message is being sent here is that in order to turn around all of these edicts so that they end up playing in our favor, the message that Esther and Mordechai are sending to us is we've assimilated. We really are am mifuzar u'miforad. We really are too dispersed within the empire. And what do we have to do? Nikalu, we've got to get together, we've got to reunify, we've got to reintegrate, we've got to assemble, we've got to remember who we are. Therefore, Rashi says, why is the emphasis when we have Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha, Mishpacha U'Mishpacha, Rashi says, Mitasfim Yachad, we all have to get together in a public gathering, of course partying, because that's the whole motif of this Megillah, but the right kind of partying, a Yom Tov, a proper partying. So that the last term that is a phrase that's emphasized is kimu v'kimu. L'kayim is constantly re-emphasized. Why? The only way B'nai Yisrael will win is that if we have kiyum, we have continuity, we have stability, we have harmony. That's our nahafochu. We have to get rid of the semblance of the stability of the dat of Persia. We have to restore the balance, the equilibrium with the dat of Torah, to reaffirm Torah and mitzvot. So when we have our mishteh v'simcha, we have to remember it's not only that we are enjoying and happy. We are overturning what the parties represented at the beginning of the Megillah, when Ahasuerus tried to impose his own set of laws and edicts to get us to assimilate and become one with his empire. We are now celebrating the reaffirmation of Torah and Mitzvot. This is the true Simcha, when it's not La'asot Kirtzon Ish Va'ish, but La'asot Kirtzon HaTorah, like Pirkei Avot says, Asei Ritzoncha Kirtzono. That's the true Kimu V'Kiblu. So therefore, at the end of the Megillah, we have constant emphasis. Katav Mordechai, Vayichtov Mordechai, Amarim HaSefer, Vatichtov Esther, et Kol Tokef, with full royal authority to establish Kiyum Purim and the Lo Yavor. Yemei Purim is Lo Yavor, not the laws of Persia. Why is it so important that we write down this Megillah, Kitvuni Ledorot? Because everything in the Megillah evolved around written laws, edicts sealed with the ring of the king. And the only way that we can properly show a true Nahafochu is through our written text that preserves for posterity the mitzvah and the miracle of Purim. And that's why in Source 21, Rav Nachman says, why don't we say Hallel on Purim as compared to Hanukkah? Because Kriyata Zo Halila, the reading of the Megillah itself, is the Hallel. But the only way you can understand it is to pay attention to how everything that is Niftav Basefer counteracts all the written decrees, all the dat and the davar, mitzvah, ma'amar, that was a major aspect of this narrative, and now we have Yemei Purim, Lo Yavor, as opposed to the dat of Persia. Thank you very much.